Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the RightStream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to the RightStream Radio Network. This is Military Monday, and I am your host, John Gresham, and it is a gorgeous, gorgeous day here in Fairfax, Virginia. Just really surprising for this summer. I mean, after the incredibly unpleasant winter we had, we are having a truly sparkling summer here in the Mid-Atlantic region, and it's a great day to start thinking ahead a little, because later this year, we're going to celebrate the 25th anniversary of what a lot of people consider to be a seminal event in the history of the world. 25 years ago, that's 1989 for those of you who can't do the math real quickly, the world changed fundamentally in November and December with the fall of the Berlin Wall and something we today call the Velvet Revolution. It was functionally the end of communism as we knew it in the 20th century. This didn't mean there weren't communist-based nations elsewhere in the world, China, Vietnam, and such, but it meant the end of an almost 50-year East-West conflict that went on, and frankly, when I was a kid, we thought it was going to be there for our entire lives. Imagine our shock one November night, sitting there watching CNN, and everybody's playing the Ode to Joy. Now, this didn't just happen. This happened as a result of a lot of hard work. Much of it was intellectual. It wasn't just building weapons and standing guard at the Fulda Gap. It also were people who had the intelligence, the vision, and the forethought, and frankly, a certain amount of worldly experience, to go and decide, okay, how are we going to go and deal with the people on the other side of the wall? How are we going to go and go forward policy-wise in that conflict? And there were a lot of very talented people in the United States and around the world who helped go and formulate that policy. Some of their names are very well known. McGeorge Bundy, Henry Kissinger, Walt Rostow, Paul Nitze, and General Brett Scowcroft. But there were also a lot of them who never made the newspapers, who never, shall we say, got their due for the exceptional work they did, and frankly, the very visionary things they published and discussed. We're going to talk about one of those individuals who maybe didn't get all of the recognition he was due, but frankly was a huge influence across the globe. His name was Robert Robert Cower. My brain, it's Monday, I'm still drinking coffee. His name was Robert Cower, and there's a new biography on him out from our good friends at Naval Institute Press. Thank you, Judy Heiss, for allowing me to go ahead and get a copy of the book. And we're going to be talking today with the author of that book, Frank Jones. Frank, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. Thank
Excellent.
You very much, John.
We're really pleased to have you here. And I guess the first question is, why in the world did you pick an obscure Cold War policy wonk to write this rather impressive and large book about?
Well, John, it started really from a question that a colleague had many years ago who, during the 1990s, you remember the United States was very much involved in peacekeeping and humanitarian operations in the Balkans and elsewhere in the world. And he asked me at the time, and this is the right around 2000, the year 2000, he said to me, why do we have this problem coordinating strategy, policy, and then implementing it? And I said, this is not a new phenomenon. It's a function of how government works, its complexity and the difficulty of coordination. And I said it was a problem in Vietnam. And Robert Comer, who you mentioned, was one of the principals for dealing with counterinsurgency, then called pacification, in the Vietnam War. And one of his really legacies is his understanding of how to coordinate among various departments and agencies and also with foreign governments, how to implement foreign policy or national security policy, in this case, the wartime policy of the United States with respect to Vietnam. So that's what got me interested, and I began reading about him. And as a consequence, I learned that his, although he may be well known for Vietnam, of all his experience, he had a much greater impact both in the Kennedy and Johnson years and then again in the Carter administration.
And this is really sort of the ebb and flow of these kinds of policy people as they have careers and move through government. We don't just see them serving a single administration, a single president, doing one thing and only one thing. We see them going and spanning a period of time, in this case with Comer, 4 decades, almost 5.
Absolutely. I mean, he gets his start in the early Cold War period, shortly after World War II. He comes out of that, as many men did of that generation, as a veteran of World War II, and he, within a few weeks after the creation, the establishment of the Central Intelligence Agency, he becomes an analyst and will stay in the CIA from 1947 up until early 1961.
Now, what was his background? I mean, obviously he was an individual who had seen a certain amount of history go by. I saw on the picture of his tombstone at Arlington, born in 1922. Obviously, he went through the Great Depression, as that generation did. And what was his contribution in World War II? What did he do? What did he do in the war, sir?
Well, in World War II, he served from 1943 until 1946. He had graduated from Harvard in 1942 and thought that he was going to go in as an officer into the Army, and then because of the program that he was in, it was canceled. They needed soldiers, and he found himself all of a sudden as Private Comer in the United States Army. He was, because he spoke fluent French and spoke some German, he was put into military intelligence, and his initial assignment was as a linguist. However, in 1944, he was asked to join what was then the beginnings of the Combat Historian Program, and that's what he did. Then he would serve in military intelligence and this historical role throughout the war, and then would leave in 46. He would also at that time be at Anzio, and he would have his birthday at Anzio, a very young man, and that would be a formative experience for him. And he would actually write, along with a junior officer, the real beginning history of the Anzio battle, which later the U.S. Army would print as part of its World War II series in 1949. So he had a number of roles. He worked on various division staffs, et cetera, as a military intelligence officer. He would be promoted to a lieutenant, and he would leave the Army in 1946 as a captain.
Okay, so this is a guy, well-educated by contemporary standard, a graduate of Harvard back when they certainly were turning out great minds and thinkers, did his share to help win the war, and obviously had gone and endured the hard years of the Depression with everybody else. What happens, though, in the late part of 1947 that changes the direction of his life and what it is he contributes to the country he obviously is beginning to love so much?
Well, he graduates from Harvard Business School with a master's degree in business administration in 1947, and like a lot of veterans, he's having some difficulty finding work, and a friend tells him about the possibility of going into intelligence work before the CIA had been established, and he actually applies for the predecessor organization called Central Intelligence Group. And he then pesters for a number of months the personnel office there about getting an appointment to the organization. And within weeks after, as I mentioned, the CIA's formation, he is told that he is now being brought on as a foreign area specialist. And he would begin his career as really in the early few months of the CIA's beginning as an organization. He, for the first few years of his career, he is an analyst. In his unpublished memoirs, which his son Doug Comer made available to me, he mentions that the portfolio he had was not very interesting, and it wasn't of interest to his superiors. He was looking at coal production and issues with the newly formed United Nations. And as you can remember from that period, this is the period of the Marshall Plan. It's also the beginning of the fraying of the relationship between the Soviet Union and the United States, who had been wartime allies. And a major event in 1950 really changes the course of his career, and that's the North Korean invasion of South Korea. And that really begins to move him into the main focus of analysis in the Central Intelligence Agency.
Now, it's worth noting that prior to 1947, the United States did not have a national-level intelligence agency per se. The military services had their intelligence organizations. The State Department maintained something akin to an intelligence organization. But other than the wartime OSS, there had been no intel group like that, correct?
Absolutely. And the early CIA, as you were indicating, had to take on a role that had to be established almost from nothing.
And it came about as a result of probably the single most important and influential piece of legislation of the mid-20th century, something we benignly call the National Security Act. Explain what that was and why it is to this day one of the most important documents in the history of American government.
It has its beginnings perhaps from two events that are very important in American history. The first is Pearl Harbor and the concern by the U.S. Congress after World War II that there needed to be an organization or a set of organizations that began to look at threats against the United States, and intelligence was one element of that. And then during World War II, there was an understanding that there was a need to be able to coordinate the various military services, and there was also the movement toward the creation, the establishment of an independent U.S. Air Force, So those factors were bubbling up in the 1945-46 time period, and there was a decision by the Congress, many who were noticing how the world was changing very dramatically right after the war. And the Congress in 1947, as you mentioned, had the National Security Act of 1947, which established not only the Central Intelligence Agency, but was also led to first the National Military Establishment, which later becomes the Defense Department after some amendments in the late 40s. And then also the role of the Secretary of Defense. So it is really the foundational statute for the national security apparatus we have today, and to use that term even more broadly, it established the National Security Council, which is the president's advisors, the principal advisors to the president on national security policy issues. Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State are two of the most of the principles of that council. But it was a way, again, to get the president to have outside advice coming in and helping him frame national security policy.
And this would stay essentially unchanged in place until the late 1980s, 30 years later, when Goldwater Nichols and Nunn Cohen were passed.
Yes, absolutely. Those are part of the same title in the U.S. laws, and it's important. These are evolutionary developments as we begin to learn about, again, joint military education and joint service relationships, which come out of other experiences in the 1980s with the Goldwater-Nichols Act in 1986, as you mentioned, and then also the Cohen-Nunn Amendment to the National Security Act, which also sets up the Special Operations Community. So these are very important developments later on in the Cold War.
So here is young Mr. Comer. He He's made a great start. He's literally on the ground floor somewhere in the scattered buildings that make up CIA around D.C. at the time. There was no big campus the way there is today at Langley, Virginia. It literally was scattered in spare space, building, Quonset huts, you name it. Where was he and what was he working on as the 40s turned into the 50s?
In 1950, it really is the major change, and it will be the change in his career that will catapult him for the next about 10 years, next decade, and bring him to the senior ranks of the Central Intelligence Agency. In 1950, as I mentioned earlier, there's the North Korean invasion of South Korea. And that was an event in which many political leaders in the United States felt that the lack of attention to that threat, to that actual event, that the Central Intelligence Agency was not paying attention to it. And there was a change in leadership in the Central Intelligence Agency at that time. And the gentleman who was brought in to become the director was a retired general, Walter Bedell Smith, or Beetle Smith, as known, who was the chief of staff for General Eisenhower during World War II. It was said of Smith that he was the most even-tempered man there was, always angry. Smith.
Well, it is worth remembering. This is the man who had to take George Patton's and Field Marshal Montgomery's phone calls.
Absolutely. He was a tough man, and he hires the former head, you mentioned OSS earlier, the head of research and analysis for OSS during World War II, a man by the name of William Langer, who was a noted U.S. historian and diplomatic historian. And he brings Langer back from Harvard. He asks him to come down from Harvard to begin what is called the Office of National Estimates. And the idea was to create an office within CIA that would have the responsibility for doing threat analysis, to do long-term intelligence assessments. And Langer is brought in for this purpose. And Langer had a number of people who were in CIA that he knew, and one of them is Robert Comer. And so he forms this small office, a small staff within this office, look at intelligence, long-time strategic intelligence. And Comer, because of his relationship with Langer, had been one of his students at Harvard, he's drawn into this small group along with Ray Klein and many other important thinkers of this period in the intelligence community. And from 1950 on through up through 1956, he is working in this area of intelligence analysis, long-term strategic intelligence. And Comer stays in that role. Within a year after Langer has come from Harvard, he returns to Harvard. Otherwise, he's going to lose his tenured position. And the man who succeeds him is a man by the name of Sherman Kent. And Sherman Kent is also a former OSS analyst. He is a PhD in history from Yale. And he is known also as a very tough customer, a very intellectually demanding man. And actually, Comer thrives under Sherman Kent. Kent is known today perhaps as the father of strategic intelligence, and what he gives the intelligence community at this time, based upon his experience in World War II on analysis, is he gives them a methodology, a way of thinking about how intelligence analysis should be done. And he treats intelligence analysis as if it were a social science, much like sociology, political science. He combines that. And Comer thrives under Kent's tutelage during this period.
Now, let's talk a little bit about what does it mean to be in the Office of Estimates, and in particular, the organization that Kent personally headed within that group, the Office of National Estimates. They did not produce per se products like in the sense that there was a hard widget or a wrench or anything like that. What they generated was paper, and the most famous of these in many ways were what were called NIEs, or National Intelligence Estimates. These were the golden geese that if you had access to them within government, you were someone, and you were being given what was felt was the best information to make decisions and to make policy that was possible in the United States government. Explain that, please.
Sure. The idea was that this was, as you said, a product that went through intense vetting, and it was written primarily by a small group of analysts. Kent had the view that you needed a combination of people who were specialists, but you also needed people who were generalists, people who could look at something in a big picture way, if you will, and see how various elements, political, diplomatic, economic, et cetera, fit together into a composite picture, if you will. And so Comer and his other colleagues were part of this small group of men, they were all men almost during that period, who would also begin to look at issues to deal with Soviet capabilities, or they might look at what was then called the Third World, the developing world. They would look at issues that are happening in various places of the world, and they would begin to create, as you pointed out, a product, a national intelligence estimate that would be used by the senior policymakers, the president and other top leaders, cabinet officers, and they would begin to flesh this out so that it represented, as you aptly put it, a national intelligence estimate. It was the best estimate that the intelligence community, both the civilian and the military, could give as a product to these men and women who had to make policy decisions for the United States.
Now, these estimates became so important that an actual system of numbering was developed so that you could keep track of it. For example, there were usually NIEs on subjects of high interest that were numbered based upon what series of work that was being done and what year it was. One of the more memorable ones is the Strategic Forces estimates, which were absolutely the most important document in terms of planning what kinds of nuclear weapons and delivery systems we were going to have to deal with and what we ourselves were going to do. Talk a little bit about that process of creating a serialized set of estimates.
Well, as you put it, this is a process by which the intelligence community in general, and particularly this small group of men at the time, are trying to gather intelligence from various sources, and they're putting it together and trying to make as best they can, and given the fact that some of these countries in which they're looking at, the Soviet Union and others, are almost opaque to them, they're trying to make estimates based upon whatever sources they have, either classified or unclassified sources, and beginning to draw upon that information in order to create this picture. It's important because not only are they doing it for, as you pointed out, strategic weapons, but also conventional forces and other elements that may be involved in this, they're also called upon to do special national intelligence estimates for those that are on a particular issue that senior leaders want to know more about. And so they are producing a lot of material during this period, and they're doing it in various areas. Comer himself will work on European and African issues. He will also work on South Asia and the Middle East. And so a lot of the regions of the world are being examined very closely. These men are also doing what they're trying to anticipate in many ways, what the issues are going to be. And they're being asked by policymakers to make judgments. And so they're using what Kent's methodology, which is really this methodology of trying to understand in a very strategic way, and by that I mean they're drawing upon various elements of information, and they're also trying to put it into a picture for these leaders so that they can see how there may be an emerging threat, there may be something that's going on right now that currently that needs some attention, but they have to understand trends, they have to understand projections, and that was part of their responsibility, was trying to anticipate what might be the future threat or problem that the U.S. policymakers would face.
And in terms of the tools they had to make these things. This is at a time when word processors were not a piece of software, but it was a room full of secretaries with these amazing new IBM Selectric typewriters bashing away on version after version of edited material, trying to keep up with the people who were handwriting it or typing it themselves, correct?
Absolutely. And on top of that, you're also dealing with a period of time where there are technological advances in terms of how one gets information, and so they're feeding that in as well. And so this is a period of, I mean, we're talking about the 1940s and 1950s, where there's a technological revolution going on as well. And so those sources are being drawn on in ways that they had not been done before, where human intelligence was the primary source of information or intelligence.
Good examples of that being the establishment of the National Security Agency, NSA, or as we call it in this part of town, the No Such Agency at Fort Meade, which was regularly establishing stations in various forward areas, flying aircraft, using ships, submarines, whatever, to collect all variety of electronic intelligence. And of course, somewhere in the middle of that decade comes the monstrously important and surprising to a lot of people development of strategic overhead imaging in the form of the U-2 spy plane and then later the Corona satellites. All of this feeds into this big machine, which is actually, as you say, a very small group of people desperately trying to go and do these assessments. It must have been an entirely insane, stressful publishing environment of those days.
It was, and the staff itself, it's a very grinding experience. I mean, Comer himself says that it was a period in which he learned an incredible amount. But after 5 or 6 years, he was interested in having a different experience. And he was used by other agencies during this period as well and worked on some other projects outside the Central Intelligence Agency. So he was being recognized within the agency itself as one of their up-and-coming young intelligence officers.
What happened to him after, in the late 1950s? What does he do in the second Eisenhower administration that makes him stand out so much?
Well, he asks his superiors, actually he asks Sherman Kent, if he can have a year to go to the National War College in Washington, D.C. at Fort McNair. And he is a student there from 1956 to 1957. And after he completes that, the Deputy Director for Intelligence at CIA, a man by the name of Robert Amory, asks him to become his special assistant. And so from 1957 until early 1961, Robert Comer will work on a group called, he'll be called the Special Assistant to the Deputy Director for Intelligence, but his principal responsibility will be working for Amory and also on the National Security Council staff, which was called the Planning Board. Planning Board was a group of young analysts, men of primarily, who were involved in actually helping the Eisenhower administration craft its thinking about specific policy. So he had moved from the intelligence world into the planning world and into the national security policymaking world, and it's one that he enjoyed immensely. And he will spend the next 3 to 4 years doing that work.
It's worth noting, and I'd like to just put a plug in, Sherman Kent stands today as a giant in the intelligence business, both for his individual achievements along the way, but also as arguably one of the great mentors of intelligence analysts and operatives for the time we were fortunate enough to have him in CIA. In retrospect, what kind of a man was he to work for? You said he was demanding, but Comer seems to have, as you say, thrived underneath him. What qualities did Kent have that allowed Comer to make such a good thing of it?
I think there are several things they demanded. It was intellectually demanding work. He was known as Buffalo or Buffalo Bill. I think that tells you something, and I don't mean that in terms of the Western hero, but Buffalo in the sense of his hard-headed, striving, like a buffalo, snorting and going and pounding heads if he needed to. He was that type of guy. He was nothing squeamish about him. He was could be abrasive, and certainly he would fight for his own ideas and for the ideas of the people that worked for him. But I think what it gave Comer, a couple of things. One was the precision of analysis, the precision of language, the ability to speak and to write concisely and to the point, the ability to see things broadly, not just narrowly, but to see them broadly and to understand how these various components or elements make up an issue and how you can attack it from various ways. So I think Comer's intellectual capacity, which was certainly there, he graduated magna cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa from Harvard, but I think his thinking was fine-tuned. And I think what also that Kent gave him was, I often see Comer as a man with a mental map in which he visualizes how things interrelate, not in terms of just the issues involved and the points of that issue, but also the geopolitical relationships that exist in the regions that he worked on. So he had a very good sense of geography and how that affected national interests of other nations. That's important for us to recall. It's not that these men were just serving U.S. national interests. They were putting themselves in the place of the other countries, their adversaries, competitors, or friendlies, and thinking about how they perceived what was going on in the world, too. That's a very important distinction.
We're going to talk a little more about Mr. Comer when we come back from these network messages, and we'll be back shortly. This is the Right Stream Radio Network.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for Right Stream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Right Stream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Right Stream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network. Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to Right Stream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvez. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the Right Stream Radio Network.
Honor Flight provides, at no cost to the veteran, the opportunity to see the memorial that the American people have built on our National Mall. And I think that there's probably no better organization out there today that can provide something to somebody for nothing.
If anyone wants to see the importance of Honor Flight, look into the veterans' eyes and how they tear up when they are brought here.
When they walk into that memorial and they see that their friends will never be forgotten, that the sacrifice that they paid will always be cherished, always revered, always honored by this nation, they're taken back by that.
The best program I've ever been associated with. You know, we're all in the same fraternity. If it hadn't been for these guys, I don't know where we'd be today or what language we'd speak.
I say about the terrorist, Al-Qaeda, if it weren't for these guys, We wouldn't have to worry about terrorists today. We'd already be occupied. We'd already be a different country. So we owe them a lot.
We're racing against a clock. In another 5 to 7 years, it'll be a moot point. They will be gone. We're working as fast as we can, but we need so much support from so many people to make these dreams a reality. This is probably the last chapter in their lives, and for some, it's literally the last paragraph of their lives. What a way to end their stories.
This has been one of the really great days of my life.
I'm sure glad I was able to live long enough to see it.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
And we are back. It is Military Monday, and we are talking with Frank Jones about his book, Blowtorch, which is a biography of Mr. Robert Comer, one of the really important national security thinkers of the Cold War. Are you still with us there, sir?
Yes, I am, John. Thank you.
1961 arrives, and there's a big change in Washington. It's the arrival of a new administration under President John F. Kennedy, a very different man, both in age and worldview from General Eisenhower. Where Eisenhower was a grandfather and had commanded some of the largest armies in American history and some of the greatest campaigns in American history, John Kennedy was a relatively young man, one of the youngest presidents on record, and his military experience had been limited to a tour or two in naval intelligence and getting a and commanding a PT boat with just 13 guys aboard, which wound up getting run over by a Japanese destroyer. Very different wartime experiences in World War II. What was it that John Kennedy brought to the national security and foreign relations policies of the United States when he arrived in 61?
Well, as you said, John, he does bring a different attitude, a different view of the world. He is very much interested in being an activist president with respect to foreign policy. He wants to primarily manage it out of the White House as opposed to relying on cabinet officers such as the State Department. And he is interested. He's been not only has he been a presidential candidate, he's been a senator and a congressman from Massachusetts, and he's very interested in international relations or foreign affairs. He's taken a personal interest in this for a number of years. So he brings an energy to it, and that energy is seen in his first inaugural address when he talks about a new generation taking over and about being involved in the world in a way that is a counterpoint, if you will, at least as people saw it at that time, to the Eisenhower administration.
And you make the point. This was not a president who was going to go and quietly manipulate events from the background. He was very much an in-your-face, hands-on, go out and talk to people and make statements kind of president. What does this mean to the National Security Council and the organizations that previously had made foreign and national security policy?
Well, the general, I guess the way to summarize it would be that he streamlines it. This comes out of the viewpoint in the late 1950s that the Eisenhower system of the National Security Council system is too top-heavy, too ponderous, needs to be streamlined, and it needs to be taken care of in a way that is less bureaucratic. And Robert Comer steps into this change quite by happenstance. He thinks he's going back to the Central Intelligence Agency, which he's not particularly thrilled with, and yet he is actually asked to stay on in the Kennedy administration, and he becomes one of the small number of staff members in the National Security Staff for President Kennedy.
Now, let us make it very clear. This was, by any standard, whatever you may think of them, their ideas, and their eventual achievements, this was a bunch of rock stars in the national security environment. McGeorge Bundy, Henry Kissinger, NITSE. These are people that we speak of reverently, and he was one of them.
Yeah, he was, and it's, as I mentioned, it was quite interesting, his connection. He's about to leave the White House staff to go back to CIA, and a few days before he leaves, he writes a memorandum for McGeorge Bundy, who's coming in as President Kennedy's national security advisor, and basically says to him that in the memorandum, there are many issues that you will have to deal with, but there are many issues that you are not even, that are at the subsurface, they're below the surface, and yet I want to bring these to your attention because they may come to be much more salient over the next few months during this transition period. He writes that memo, gives it to Bundy, and while I was doing the research for the book at the Kennedy Museum, I found the memorandum, and annotated in the side of it was, "This is the man I told you about." The annotation was by William Bundy, McGeorge Bundy's brother. William Bundy had been on the CIA staff, knew Robert Comer, and McGeorge Bundy had asked his brother to recommend to him some professionals, national security professionals, who he could have on the National Security Council staff that would help him manage process and also who understood how Washington worked. As you suggested, these were men coming from the outside, from academia and other places, corporations, etc., who knew, were very bright men, but not necessarily involved in how the machinery government. They didn't know how to sometimes move the levers of government. And that's what they wanted from Comer, and his memorandum really piqued their interest, and he was brought on to the council staff.
It's worth noting, and as most of my listeners know, I've spent some time at presidential libraries researching my own articles and books, particularly DEFCON 2 that I did with Norman Pollmar a few years back about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I was struck by how important well-written memorandums were within the National Security Council as well as the people they served, including the president, that the writing of good memorandums was not just a task. Doing it well was absolutely necessary and a requirement if you were going to stay around that place.
Absolutely, because what you're vying for is time on the president's calendar in many ways. One only has to go, as you just suggested, go to the presidential libraries. You can even do it online now and look at the daily schedule of a president. It's just crammed with events and other phone calls and other activities. And so you're trying to bring the president, regardless of when you're on the domestic staff or those dealing with foreign policy, you're dealing with very important issues, and you have to be able to write clearly and directly and concisely so that the president understands the issues and can speak to them. Should he go to a press conference? Should he engage with a head of state or head of government, et cetera? So, yes, it's very important.
And it's worth noting that if you're doing this, it's not just because you want to get noticed professionally. You're trying to go and compete, as you say, for mind share and attention span, because this is how the president usually first learns that something is absolutely going to crack somewhere in the world and that he needs to take an interest in it, correct?
Absolutely. And as you know, this is really the beginning of the presidential briefings by the CIA. It starts to come to fore during this period. So the president is getting that. But it is insufficient. As you said, there's a great deal of sophistication in these areas, a complexity in these areas. And therefore, you have to have someone explain it, usually somebody who's knowledgeable about that in terms of a regional background or a functional background. And on top of that, you have the whole need to try to begin to educate the president, who's got many other things on his mind.
Yeah, and the agency really put a lot of effort into this. I remember one of the more well-known incidents of this was the work by the heads of the National Photographic Intelligence Center to go and educate John Kennedy in the use of reconnaissance photography in policymaking, because, of course, Eisenhower had thought up, you know, strategic overhead reconnaissance and had been a consumer of intelligence voraciously going back to when he was chief of staff to MacArthur in the Philippines. John Kennedy didn't have that background, did he?
No, and he and many others on his staff, his media staff, the people he brought in, had to learn those issues. But he chose, as I said, early in his administration to have this small National Security Council staff. So someone like Comer, after they split up portfolios several months into the first year of the administration, Comer is responsible for an area that runs from Morocco, basically on the Atlantic Ocean, all the way over to Indonesia. Along that stretch in North Africa all the way across. So he himself has a huge portfolio that he has to pay attention to.
And this is not a quiet time in that portfolio because, well, let's just list a few thumbnail things that happened in those 3 years that Comer had to deal with. And let's start in North Africa with a irritating little gentleman by the name of Colonel Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt.
Right. Because Comer's portfolio includes the Middle East, he's intimately involved with that. And, of course, he's interested in a couple of different things. This is the period of the rise of nationalism in many ways. It's the period of decolonization. And Comer is seeing that firsthand when he looks at a map of North Africa and the Middle East. Israel has been recognized as a state several years earlier, so there's an interest in the relationship, the partnership, if you will, the friendship between the United States and Israel. And so Comer's job is part of this is tension to Nasser and nationalism, and he is interested from a policy standpoint, as is Kennedy, on how to deal with these what were called the non-aligned states, the states that weren't particularly aligned with the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact or the Western, the West, so-called West at the time, the United States and the NATO allies. And so Comer's thinking on this subject is how do you focus Nasser to talk about development and to think about development of his own state or his own nation, Egypt, and not to be meddling, if you will, in other parts and causing disruptions and irritations in other parts of the Middle East. And so he's determined as part of the U.S. policy at that time to begin to focus on Nasser as an important person to have a better relationship with the United States with. He never expects, as is the case with some of the other non-aligned movements that he works or countries with a part of the non-aligned movement. He never expects them to become allies of the United States, but he does want to have good relations with them.
Moving east, he gets to deal with another non-aligned nation with another rather activist leader, and this is the state of India, which had, of course, been formed after the partition in the late 1940s, and its disconnection from the British Empire, run by a rather powerful gentleman in his own right by the name of Nehru.
Yes, this is an interesting story because Comer is part of almost a triumvirate of people that are interested in India and its future. The other two people are John Kenneth Galbraith, the well-known economist who's the U.S. ambassador, and an assistant secretary of state by the name of Phillips Talbot, T-A-L-B-O-T. And Talbot is a former army officer. He'd served in World War II as an army officer, and he had served in the China-Burma-India theater. So he is more grounded in India than he is in the Arab world. He's the assistant secretary for Near East and South Asia. These three men have a view of the criticality of India, a large democracy. And Comer, I think, is very prescient in this way. He begins to see India as really a country that the United States needs to develop stronger ties with. He sees them as the future. He sees them as the future as a counterbalance to then the People's Republic of China. And so he begins also is very much prompting John F. Kennedy, President Kennedy, to create a good, solid relationship with the Indian leadership, as you mentioned. And this is something Kennedy also has a similar mindset about. So the two of them are very much in synchronized in their thinking here.
And, of course, they had to do some pretty fast dancing in 1962 because right at the exact same time that the Cuban Missile Crisis was going on, war broke out as a result of a border dispute between the People's Republic of China and India. And frankly, most of the rest of the government was focused on that little island 90 miles away off our coast, and it was really left to Comer and Galbraith to go ahead and provide support and guidance to solve it.
Absolutely. As you rightly point out and have written about, the attention was on the Cuban Missile Crisis, and rightly so. I mean, that was an important, really catalytic event in American foreign policy and remains so today. What Comer, Galbraith are trying to do is get some attention paid to India because of, you mentioned, the border dispute between China and India. And Comer sees that event as a way to balance the relationship between the United States and India, which he felt was out of kilter. He felt that it was skewed more to U.S.-Pakistan because of some of the reasons you mentioned before about the Pakistan government being very much a place where American intelligence capabilities were, and he wants to balance it. He wants to really walk a tightrope between the two, India and Pakistan, and he wants to change that balance a little bit. He also believes that this is an opportunity to create that relationship, and he works with British and other Commonwealth nations to start to begin a dialogue. And there's actually some actual help that's given to the Indians by in terms of material support during this period. Unfortunately, that happens in late 1962, this skirmish, this border dispute, and Kennedy will die a year later in 1963, in November of 63, and the energy behind this process fades with Kennedy's assassination.
One last area where he was very active, and much of what he would do later was affected by this, was, of course, down in Indonesia. Again, another non-aligned nation headed at the time by some call him a dictator, some call him another strongman, by the name of Sukarno. Talk a little bit about that real quick.
Yeah, I think this is another case where Comer is, again, looking ahead, and Western New Guinea or Irian area is moving from decolonization from Dutch or the Netherlands to become not part of that, no longer part of the former Dutch East Indies. And again, Comer sees Indonesia as the key in Southeast Asia or South and that part of the world. And he's interested in, again, in using non-aligned movement, nationalists, and getting them to focus on their own issues. But he also wants to turn Netherlands away from colonization. He believes the United States, in terms of its values, can't support colonialism. And he begins to argue to the president that we need the Dutch to consider their role in NATO and not their former colonies. And so he's really, if I could just draw a larger picture here, he's really interested in this period place from east of Suez. He sees the British moving out of that area, the decolonization happening, the changing, the rise of nationalism, and he begins to see that as a critical part or critical arc in the world, and he begins to think that's where the United States will probably have some of its most important future interests.
So he's beginning to see what we talk about but seem to ignore all too much in American policy, the creation of power vacuums and the fact that if someone doesn't fill them, someone bad probably will.
Absolutely. And he's prescient in the sense also that he begins to see that with the British leaving, the Americans may become responsible for that area, and I use that word advisedly, but somewhat have an interest there, and he begins to understand how the United States might put forces, military forces in there, not in Middle East itself, but he begins the dialogue that happens between the British and the United States over an island which will become very important in the Persian Gulf War, namely Diego Garcia. And it's his initiative during that period to talk to the British about the use of leasing capability or part of the island for American forces.
We'll talk a little more about that later. Like everybody else in government at that time, Comer was rocked and completely disjointed by the assassination of John Kennedy. And it wasn't as much the assassination of Kennedy as it was the coming of Lyndon Johnson. Talk a little bit about Lyndon Johnson as a national security and foreign policy leader and why he wound up going and starting to depend so much on Robert Comer.
Well, I think there are two things here that are of interest to your audience. The first is the fact that Johnson's leadership style is very different from Kennedy's. Kennedy is, I said earlier, an activist in foreign policy. I mean, he wants to draw in that control into the White House, if you will. However, he uses a very collegial system. He reaches out to people. He gets many different sources of information. Lyndon Johnson is more concerned about leaks. He wants to rely more on his cabinet officials that are involved in this, namely Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara and Secretary of State Dean Rusk. But he had traveled with Robert Comer. Robert Comer had accompanied then Vice President Johnson for a trip that Johnson made on behalf of Kennedy into the Middle East. And he had come to know Comer very well and thought very highly of Comer. May have been, as Johnson called him, a Harvard, one of the Harvards, but he liked the fact that Comer was a straight-talking Missourian, and he was a guy that, much like Johnson, was prone at times, for effect, to use very down-to-earth, earthy language. And so they got along very well. So he wants Comer to stay on, as he did ask for many of the other Kennedy people to stay on, and so Comer does make that commitment. He believes that he serves the office of the president, not just the president.
And it's worth noting that a goodly portion of this undoubtedly comes from the fact that Lyndon Johnson was an underutilized resource by the Kennedy administration. Of course, there is the legendary dislike that was going on between he and Robert Kennedy, but he just was not properly used as a resource. So obviously he had very few friends in government during that time. And to actually meet someone like Comer who treated him with respect and actually traveled with him, shared time and space, must have made Comer a very attractive entity to him when he took over as president.
Yeah, there was a good relationship. It was ultimately, Comer will be known as Lyndon Johnson's man, and that happens even before he goes to Vietnam in 1967 and becomes the special assistant in 1966 on Vietnam issues for Lyndon Johnson. There's a kind of an interesting relationship there. On the one hand, he becomes a presidential envoy for Johnson on occasion. He is certainly listened to, but the Johnson administration, how Johnson managed, was very different, as I said, and it keeps Comer and others on rather a short leash. So Comer often felt that he was more an implementer of policy than he was someone who was helping formulate policy as he was under Kennedy. Nonetheless, they had a very good relationship.
And this was not a president who had a lot of good relationships in Washington. Obviously, the man was a giant when it came to being a legislator, as we saw when he was majority leader during the second term of the Eisenhower administration. But as a presidential leader, he couldn't always keep all the balls in the air at once, and at the same time, he suffered from certain myopias when it came to various policy elements. What does Comer do to make him more effective? And let's talk about Comer's work in 64, 65, and 66.
Yeah, I think the 66 is the big change. And as you mentioned, Lyndon Johnson is a man who is deeply rooted in the legislative branch of government, and he's a very effective legislator. His ability to translate that into a presidential role is somewhat mixed over this period. And Comer will certainly be involved in handling certain very delicate issues that Johnson wants him to handle. India, particularly, Johnson had mixed feelings about India. He tended to favor Pakistan, but he would listen to Comer over that. Comer would have an impact with him in terms of Middle East issues, particularly as Israel was involved. But it really is Vietnam in 65 that Comer finally finds himself, although he did not want to, finds himself drifting into the Vietnam orbit of Johnson, and really in March of 66, he is drawn completely in. He has been already he's thought highly of. Comer is thought highly of by Robert McNamara. McNamara tries to bring him over to the work for him at the Defense Department. He's considered it a couple of times during Johnson's administration early in this period for jobs as ambassador to a few nations. And so he is held in high regard. He's, as I said, kept in good graces with him during the period in which Johnson was vice president. But he is also chafing under this restraint that he finds himself in. In 66, what changes is that Johnson makes him his special assistant. First, he becomes a deputy for national security affairs, and then he makes him his special assistant for Vietnam reconstruction in early 1966. And what he makes Comer responsible for is really the direction and the coordination and the supervision in Washington of all the non-military programs that deal with the nation-building, the U.S. efforts of nation-building in South Vietnam. And that sets Comer off into the next major aspect of his role in the Johnson administration, first as special assistant, and then he will go in 1967 to Vietnam to work for General Westmoreland.
A couple of people he runs into and works with figure very important during that effort, and just give us a quick word about both of them. One is a gentleman by the name of John Paul Vann, and the other one is a somewhat better-known individual who would later lead the CIA, William Colby.
Yes, both of these men are, among others, who he reaches out to. Colby is a well-established figure in the Central Intelligence Agency. He had been the station chief in Saigon. He's well-versed in some of these matters of Asia and intelligence there. And Comer will later make him his deputy in Vietnam. So he's already dealt with Bill Colby, and Bill Colby during this period actually briefs Clomer in 1966, and they got to get to know each other. John Paul Vann is another person that Clomer meets and is impressed with his knowledge of South Vietnam, and he will use him throughout 66 as a sounding board for his ideas, among other people that he will do that with. And so he also hires a couple of young members to be part of his staff in the White House, one by the name of Richard Holbrooke, Ambassador Holbrooke, and another, a young Army officer by the name of Robert Montague, who's worked in Vietnam under Westmoreland and been an advisor with the South Vietnamese Army. So he begins to really reach out to these men who have long experience with Vietnam.
And despite his best efforts, of course, 1968 comes, and it just throws everything into a cocked hat because of the Tet Offensive and the very personal decision by Lyndon Johnson to not run for re-election and, in fact, to essentially disengage from American politics and end his career.
Yes, I mean, during this period of 1967, Clomer leaves the United States at President Johnson's request and becomes the deputy for civil operations and rural development support, Revolutionary Development Support, which is the CORDS program, which is the counterinsurgency program the United States sets up. And Clomer spends most of 1967 setting up the single manager, a concept to integrate military, political, economic, and social development issues. It is also the beginning of the elimination of what is called the Viet Cong infrastructure. Later, the program is first called ISICS and then becomes the famous or infamous Phoenix program later under Bill Colby. And he will spend that first year of 1967 doing that. And as you mentioned, they think 1968 will be the year that they can really put counterinsurgency and pacification on the fast track, and TET happens in January of that year. And Clomer will spend the next few months helping the South Vietnamese government, working with them directly, with the Vice President of South Vietnam, Vice President Ky, recovering from this. That will actually be a major turning point in terms of the trusting relationship that Clomer will develop. And he'll bring Colby to Vietnam at that time, and the two of them will begin to work very diligently. But as you suggested, with Johnson's decision not to run in 1968, and the change, General Westmoreland leaves in June, and Creighton Abrams takes over the military head of the commander of Military Assistance Command of Vietnam. That's a period in which there's a great deal of friction. And ultimately, in the fall of 1968, November of 1968, Clomer will leave Vietnam.
He does a short tour as the ambassador to Turkey, sort of a political reward from Johnson to, give him something for all of his hard work. And sadly, he is swept out of government with the coming of Richard Nixon and his administration.
Absolutely. He will spend the next several years until 1977 working for RAND Corporation. He will write a few studies, one on the Vietnam War, his impressions in 1972, and what we can learn from the war. It's published under the title Bureaucracy Does Its Thing. It's well known today among people who have studied counterinsurgency. We've gone back and relooked at it based on our experience in Iraq and Afghanistan during since 2001. And the other thing he does is a comparative analysis of Malaysia, the British experience with counterinsurgency there, and Vietnam. And then he gets involved with something because the United States now has turned away from that part of the world and is now refocusing on Western Europe and the Soviet threat in the 1970s against NATO.
These years between 69 and 77 were very much kind of his time in the wilderness, where he got to write but wasn't included in the great happenings led by Henry Kissinger and the other individuals who did national security policy for Dick Nixon. Was he angry at this, or was he just simply experiencing what happens when you spend too much time associating with the senior leadership of one party or another?
Well, I think, first of all, he's stunned and dismayed. when he's not kept on after 1969, early 1969. He had known Henry Kissinger. Kissinger and he had been on good terms during the Kennedy administration. He gripes in his unpublished memoirs that he had given, made sure that Henry Kissinger had contracts or consulting relationships with the Kennedy administration, so he's dismayed that he firmly believed that he would be treated as a professional and not be seen as a Democratic holdover. That doesn't obviously transpire, so he's a little bit dismayed and perhaps even angry about that. But over time, yes, I think really he's happy with the work he's doing, but on the other hand, he misses the he's like the proverbial fire horse who hears the bell ring, but he can't answer the bell. And so he chafes at that as well.
And then as administrations changed again in 1976 and 1977, he builds a relationship first as a consultant and then later working for him directly in government with a very important individual who is rarely talked about even today, Harold Brown. Talk a little bit about Harold Brown and what he did with Mr. Comer.
Yeah, it's an interesting relationship. As Robert Comer describes it in his memoirs, he gets a phone call one day from Harold Brown. Now, Harold Brown had been Secretary of the Air Force in the Johnson administration, and Comer was a well-known figure, as I mentioned, and so and Brown was well familiar with Comer's Vietnam experience, but he also knew that Comer for the last several years had been working on NATO issues for Secretary Jim Schlesinger, who just recently died, and for Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld in his first iteration in the Ford administration. And so he calls him up one day in his Brown calls Comer up one day in his office in Washington and asks him what he thinks about some of the NATO issues that are going on. And Comer said that he felt like telling Brown, why don't you just read my all of the reports I've done over the last several years. But he doesn't, and he just says, well, you know, I have been working on it. And he begins to talk to him a minute. And then Brown says to him, well, how would you like to come and join me and push your ideas through the bureaucracy? And for Comer, that is the exact words that grab him and embrace him. And he says, I'd love to do that. And so he becomes, and he worries about this because of the bad, you know, almost the tainting of certain officials who are associated with Vietnam. He's afraid he will not get into this process, but it does come to pass, and he becomes for a few years Harold Brown's special advisor for NATO affairs. And he will take that role and begin to push the revitalization of the conventional capability of NATO to counteract the Soviet growth and the Warsaw Pact growth that had taken place while the United States was fixated on Vietnam. The Soviets had built up their defense budget and their conventional capability in Eastern Europe, and now were worried. There were people in the United States government, including the Carter administration, who were worried about this growth of potential.
Now,
so we,
there's
no,
a
I was just going to say,
particularly among, shall we say, people to the right of center in politics, that the Carter administration was fixated mostly on cutting forces, hollowing them out, and running away from commitment, overseas commitments and allies. The truth of the matter is it's not quite that clear that there were, in fact, very strong pockets within the bureaucracy, within DOD, within the Congress, which were very much concerned with where American military forces were after Vietnam. And Comer clearly was one of them.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. I mean, what he tries, he creates what's known as the Long-Term Defense Plan. This is a plan to build NATO back. As you suggested, the myth of the period is largely that it was all about cuts. That's not true, and it becomes less true after the Soviets invade Afghanistan. And at the same time, Comer is very, very, as I said before, he's very cognizant of geography, and he realizes, and people who were involved, as myself was during this period, was involved in NATO planning, there's a concern that the Soviets and their allies will overrun U.S. and NATO capabilities very quickly. And so what Comer is doing is building a concept which he would describe as a come-as-you-are war, that you put your preposition, your material, your equipment in Europe, and you bring your troops to it rather than waiting for tanks and other heavy equipment to flow by air or most likely by sea and take forever to get there, not forever, but for a long time. And so what he's trying to do is build a quick reaction, if you will, capability, until the majority of forces can get there. And so he's beginning, that's what he's thinking about, and he's also pushing, like Harold Brown is, for development of capabilities, Army capabilities and Air Force capabilities and naval in terms of sea lift, but also airlift and capabilities in the modernization of the U.S. Army. This is the era of the Abrams tank and the Bradley fighting vehicle and also some advanced helicopters. So he's pushing for all of those as well.
The programs that we today call the Big Five.
Absolutely. And missile programs, absolutely.
So he is part of a group which is fundamentally changing American strategy to having preposition sites, which I remember the acronym was POMCAS at the time.
Correct.
That you literally just put soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines onto airplanes, fly them to wherever the POMCAS site was, and they would fall in on already prepositioned, packaged brigade sets that they could go and then roll into battle with.
Absolutely, and he's also part of this movement, this as part of the long-term defense plan for building up the budgets, the commitment on the part of other NATO allies to share the burden of the costs and to raise their defense budget approximately 3% per annum in real growth.
And to this degree, they hand off, in some ways, a Defense Department, which is rapidly becoming healthier than it was after Vietnam, albeit it's only 4 years when Jimmy Carter loses, frankly, one of the most humiliating presidential elections on record. I still remember that night going, oh, my God, because so much power changed hands, not just at the White House, but also up on Capitol Hill. What happens to Mr. Comer with the coming of Ronald Reagan?
Right. In the last year of the Carter administration, he's made the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy the second person to hold that position. Harold Brown creates that to give him a person who overlooks defense policy issues writ large. And the Carter Doctrine is enunciated by President Carter in January of 1978, and that leads to the formation of the Rapid Deployment Joint Task Force and Southeast Asia basing. And Comer is largely responsible for those programs. But as you say, in 1979, he's outside of government again. He will remain outside of government, but he will become a very vocal critic of the Reagan administration, not because he's against the buildup of the capability. He certainly believes that. He believes, though, however, that it's more skewed toward the naval, seems to be more skewed, in his view, toward Navy rather than Army and Air Force, and he believes that the work that he had done and the continuing interest he has in both the Middle East and NATO, emphasis still needs to be placed there. But he will join with other people, John Glenn, Senator John Glenn is a good example, about being a vociferous critic of that.
And to a great degree, he really believed that the answer was not just to throw money at the problem, but to go ahead and focus it in the places that was needed.
Absolutely. This is part of his role, thinking strategically about this, about coalition warfare is the future as well. NATO is an example of that type of alliance relationship, and those have to be built up elsewhere in the world in order to create that. And, of course, the Reagan administration, in a way, does listen to him and to some of his staff and others who were involved in the buildup in the Middle East because we see a pouring of money into Diego Garcia. We see the creation of Central Command, et cetera. So there was an interest in doing some of this. It was just some of the more elements of strategy were a little bit different from in Comer's views.
And Comer never serves in government again.
No, unfortunately, he does not. He becomes primarily a man outside government. He writes a few books. He is involved in consulting. He becomes a consultant to the National Intelligence Council. But he feels, and he teaches at George Washington, the George Washington University and George Mason University, but he becomes really a kind of a forgotten man throughout the 1990s. He comes occasionally to conferences about Vietnam, which he's well remembered for, but that's basically it. It is the end of his career. He never becomes the elder statesman.
Which is, in its own way, a bit of a shame, considering what happened to other men who in some ways were not as influential and thoughtful as him. He dies in 2000, I believe, if I remember what it said on his headstone at Arlington. And what is his legacy as we sit here today? Because as we've talked, he's throwing around back half a century ago some ideas which we should have wisely embraced on multiple occasions and never have. What do you see as his long-term legacy, and what should be his legacy as we move into the next phase of our being a country and leadership with a leadership role in the world?
Well, I think his first legacy was he was rediscovered. His ideas about counterinsurgency and how one deals with insurgents were rediscovered after 2001. And became very much part of the Army and Marine Corps' effort in their field manual on counterinsurgency. His ideas are brought to fore. What he sees there is that counterinsurgency has two dimensions, a vertical dimension, that is, it runs from the strategic to the tactical level, from Washington down to the field level, but it is also horizontal. It has to coordinate and synchronize the military, economic, political, and social aspects. And he understands the value of organization and management and unity of effort that has to take place when you have multiple agencies and departments and governments, and that success is contingent on an ally's capability. And that's one of the things he points out. I'd say the other important concrete element of his legacy is his vision. His ability to see, that strategic vision, the ability to use his knowledge and his imagination. Now, you see that in the building up of east of American capability east of Suez and Southwest Asia, the imperative of national interests, the limits, recognizing the limits of power as he does in terms of Vietnam, and the importance of trying new things, of risk, prudent and pragmatic as he was. But again, that reaching out to India, here we are today, and our American policy toward India is very much the type of policy that Robert Comer envisioned 50 years ago. So I think he really sheds light on how to develop and implement strategies to ensure national security and protect vital interests of the United States. And I would say that many of the issues he was really dealing with, the geopolitical dynamics of the period in which he lived, are not different because he was dealing with Middle East, South Asia, Southeast Asia, etc. So I think those are his two legacies.
I want to thank you for coming on and talking about this man and giving him an identity in the minds of our listeners. I highly recommend to them the book Blowtorch that you wrote about him, which, by the way, we really never explained. Why did you name it Blowtorch?
Ah, thanks. I appreciate that. That's a great question. He was a man who was often described as difficult, irascible, fiery. And during Vietnam, when he first started working on Vietnam issues for Lyndon Johnson, was Johnson's special assistant, he went to Vietnam frequently and traveled there. And the U.S. ambassador to South Vietnam at the time was a man by the name of Henry Cabot Lodge. And Lodge was once asked by a member of the press, the American press in Saigon, what it was like with Robert Comer. And he said, working with Robert Comer is like having a blowtorch aimed at the seat of your pants. And so that is the name Blowtorch, or Blowtorch Bob, as he was known sometimes. And he reveled in that moniker.
Well, it's not the most, it's not an unkind and maybe even a little respectful. thank you so much. Sharing them. I guess the next question is, Well, you've written a great book, and it is a compelling book. I spent a fair amount of time browsing it this weekend. My question is, what's next for you?
Two projects right on. The most immediate one is I've been asked by the U.S. Army Center for Military History to write a volume or a pamphlet for its Vietnam commemorative publication series, and I'm currently working on that. It's the period covered from spring of 1965 to 1966, and that's something that the center wants to publish on the 50th anniversary with Vietnam coming up next year with that Americanization of the war. And the second project I have going on is I'm looking at the role of U.S. senators in defense policy in the 1970s and 80s. I'm very much interested in the role, particularly that Senator Sam Nunn played during that period. So I've begun work on that as my next book.
Well, it sounds like you're going to be spending some time down at Georgetown talking to he and maybe Bill Cohen. What a shame that Jackson isn't around. Listen, thank you so much for coming on, and I hope we talk again soon.
Well, John, thank you again for this opportunity. It's been a pleasure spending this time and a half, hour and a half or so with you. It's been absolutely fantastic. Thanks for inviting me.
Have a great afternoon. I envy you being in Carlisle.
Thanks. Weather's gorgeous here, too.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And with that, we come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. We'll be back next week at 1 p.m. Eastern, and we'll have another show that I hope will interest and appeal to you. This is John Gresham for the Right Stream Radio Network, signing off from Military Monday.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. Got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? I saw men on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. And he said that he's coming for me. I never loved a soldier until the walls of war. Never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man. The song to a dead man to me. I never loved a soldier until the world's a war. I thought about tomorrow till my baby hits the floor. I only talk to God when somebody's about to die. Never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. You can cry for her, die for her, lay down your life for her, kiss and wave goodbye to her. Anything at all. You can cry for her, die for her. Anything at all.
There's a baby on the doorstep wailing away. There's a baby on the doorstep longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep who gives his life to take. A flag to a pawn shop. A flag to a pawn shop. May he forget why he is